Hi, I'm Alicia Atchison. I'm vegan, an animal lover, and animal rights activist. Many people say that becoming vegan is one of the best decisions they have made in life. I'm here to share my guest stories on their choice to live a kind life and what it means for them to be vegan.
Welcome to A Kind Life. Today I'm joined by Jen. How are you going, Jen?
Yeah, I'm good, mate.
That's so good. I was just saying before we jumped on and press record that I'm just in awe of you've got this beautiful backdrop behind you in your house, which I'm sure we're going to hear about more at some point, but I'm very jealous. You're coming to us from near Noosa, is that right?
I'm about 14K from the beach. So yeah, from Main Beach, Noosa, yeah.
Very nice. Well, tell us a little bit about yourself, Jen.
Well, gosh, that's an open question, isn't it? Like, where do you start? Like, I don't know. So a little bit about myself, relevant to the topic. I've been vegan since 2012, mid-2012. I just turned 50. So yeah, I turned 50 and I'd been learning about animal rights issues for about 8-9 months, I suppose, and just had that bit of epiphany soon after turning 50. At that point, I'd been a cop. Well, in the end, I'd been a cop with Victoria Police for like 33 years. And after I went vegan, sort of saw everything differently. And I ended up leaving and starting a vegan B&B. I sort of fell into it. It wasn't a premeditated thing. It was like, what the hell am I going to do with the rest of my life if I'm not going to be this cop? Because I did everything, my whole career was to do with horses, like training horses, coaching horse riders, stuff like that. So obviously that was no longer in alignment with my values. So testing time. So yeah, so 61 now, greeny, lefty, what do they call it? Woke. I'm proudly woke. I said to someone on social media the other day, is that meant to be an insult, calling us woke? Like, really?
It's not. And how long have you lived in Noosa or just out of Noosa?
Just over 4 years, like literally this month. So I lived in the Yarra Valley in a place called Smith's Gully, which is at the foot of the King Lake Ranges, about 45 k's northeast of Melbourne. And I lived there for 25 years. So I had a 20-acre property there and I started the B&B there, so the Beet Retreat, yeah.
Yeah, wow. And so I guess there's so much. I'm really excited to talk to you because as I read through like your website and learned more about you, I thought there's so many interesting things to you, Jen. So thank you for saying yes to coming on. And guessing if you're in Vic Police for 33 years, you probably sort of went out of school and straight into the academy. Is that right?
Pretty well. I did work with horses for a while. Hello, big surprise. That was like, you know, pretty dead end job. And yeah, that had some pretty major challenges as it turned out. I was a pretty young, naive girl. And so, yeah, sort of ended up, I think I rebounded and had a bit of a nervous breakdown and worked in the shoe shop for 3 months and ended up in the police force pretty early. So,
And I guess what called you to getting involved with VicPol?
I actually met a guy through some friends who was already then like quite a long-term member of the Mounted Police, and I was like a through and through horsey girl, and I just thought, wow, that's the coolest job ever. And I used to go and, you know, like check out, going in on a Sunday and look at the stables in South Melbourne there. And I remember one day he said, well, why don't you join? Because I was in this bit of a dead-end job, you know. And I said, well, I couldn't be a cop. And he just looked at me and said, well, why not? And I didn't really have a good answer. But I just, you know, at that point I couldn't imagine it. I was only like 19 or something. Yeah. So, yeah, so I did do that. And so I was in the Mounties for 27 out of 33 years.
What's the process? I'm assuming you still go to the academy, but at some point you must like specialize in like in the horse mounted police side of things.
Yeah, that's right. So back then, I mean, I'm sure the training changes all the time with VicPol or any police force. But when I was going through, we'd go, I think we were in for about 5 months in the academy in Glen Waverley. And then you went out onto what they call training stations. So you'd spend a month at all these different sort of mostly inner city departments. So you're learning about different departments like traffic and, you know, booze buses and things like that. And then you end up at a training station. So that can be anywhere. I just went out to, you know, it was pretty well Sleepy Hollow, Nunawading back then, you know, and I think I was the only policewoman in the whole station, very naive, like 20-year-old. And from there, I mean, the whole reason I joined was to go to the mounted branch. So as soon as I was able to, after about 2 years, I went in there. But you had to, like, obviously, you know, pass the writing test, all of that. So
yeah, what is involved in terms of, yeah, like you said that you'd already had the experience in writing, but did you like have to do a lot more kind of training to then, I suppose, combine the two, like being a police officer and being on horseback?
Not so much with the thing with the Mounties. It's a different, over the years, because I was, my main role was a horse trainer, but I also ended up doing a lot of the coaching as well. So rider training. And the thing is with the rider training, you could actually, you'd have applicants that were very good riders, but some of them were inflexible into sort of letting go of their way of riding. So if they were competition riders, I'd done competitions, but sometimes people that were really good competition riders, they had struggled to let go of working their horses, as we called it. So riding their horses or training their horses in a certain way. Whereas with police horses, you actually need to get them to relax, because a lot of them used to be off the racetrack. So it's a matter of them, you know, calming them down from their previous life and being relaxed and trusting you, building this real relationship with the horse where they could be relaxed and go into a, you know, an angry crowd and not get adrenalized. Because horses are a creature of flight. So by instinct, they want to run away. So if they're under the pump, so that you really got to develop that relationship where they trust you and they're well trained. So their instinct might be to, like, got to get away from these people throwing things at us. But they take comfort with that relationship with you and the other horses that are around with them. It's probably the same. You know, you see the movies and they're all galloping into battle. You know, it's an interesting thing. Horses are extremely trainable animals, like considering their size and their bulk.
Where obviously at some point you were a mounted police officer and you went vegan. So tell us about that part of your story.
Oh, that was messy. You know, that was hard because, you know, obviously, you know, I'd loved horses since I was really young and I'd ridden horses since I was really young. And, you know, obviously dogs and cats and all that. I considered myself, like most of us, an animal lover. I really loved animals. It did occasionally enter my fairly immature mind that, like, I ate some, but not in a really specific way, like most people. You think, well, this is just what we do. I didn't know any vegans when I went vegan. I certainly knew of vegetarians. I don't think I'd ever even considered what vegan meant, or if was it possible to eat like and live healthily without eating these things? Because, you know, we're all indoctrinated with this idea that, you know, we have to eat all these things. That Four Corners episode, A Bloody Business, in 2011, I think. So that was undertaken, you know, it was Animals Australia's expose, and it was aired on Four Corners. So I saw that, and that started everything for me, because I signed up to the Animals Australia newsletter, and then I started to learn all the things. But yeah, even, you know, right back then, I think that's only when I found out that this word vegan wasn't vegetarian or something else, you know.
Yeah. And so was your sort of first step to become vegetarian, or how did that transition go for you?
I had actually been vegetarian for health reasons for just like maybe 3 years. How old would I have been? Maybe late 30s, I think, and purely for health reasons, because my dad had passed and he'd had bowel issues, and there was a lot of bowel issues in my family. And I'd read a book back in the 80s that were talking about the link between bowel disease and red meat consumption particularly. Didn't have a computer back then. We didn't have the internet. And so I just sort of made this sort of drew this line between them and thought, like, oh, I think I'm going to give up meat. I like cows anyway. and then I just end up giving up all meat. But because I didn't continue to learn about it, it was really just a concept. And I just thought I'd do this. I did get very tired. I remember I was sort of following this fit for life thing where they say, like, don't really eat much except for this before lunchtime. And I was a really active person and I was tired. So like many people that say they go vegan and they're tired, it's just you're not eating the right things, you're not eating enough. You know, I should have been, for me, for my the way I was living my life, I should have been having oats, you know, and things like that. So, but no, I was having fruit or something, you know, one piece of toast with some tomato. So,
And then at what point did you then sort of realize about dairy and eggs and decided to go vegan?
Yeah, the big dairy was the big one for me. So, you know, I was always learning about these things and I literally remember the newsletter email that came through from Animals Australia and it had the photo of bobby calves and it said 700,000 bobby calves a year are killed because they're, you know, because of the dairy industry. And I literally thought to myself, no, this can't be true. This is vegan propaganda. This they can't do that. And I went to a wedding with my then partner up the country. And so, you know, with the innocence of someone that's not vegan and is only quite new to animal activism, I was like, oh, I know this person that I used to do in the adventure racing circles, because I used to do adventure racing. I knew she was a third generation dairy farmer and she was doing her PhD in something to do with dairy because we talked about it. So I thought, oh, she'll know if that's true or not. So I've just like blindly bumbled into the lion's den by asking a dairy third generation dairy farmer if it's true they kill all these calves, you know. So of course she was well aware that people were finding out about what happens to bobby calves, and she was like, I can see now, she was sort of rightfully pissed off you know, because she saw it probably as an antagonistic question and it totally wasn't. And I did try and explain that, like, you know, but she just launched me, and I got like a fair dinkum dressing down from her. And I do remember one thing she said, do you eat dairy? And I went, yeah, some, because I wasn't vegan yet and I was still finding out. And so I was like, well, what do you expect, blah, blah, blah. So in a roundabout way, I knew it was true that they do have to dispose of bobby calves. But yeah, it was like quite the shock. Eventually, like, her partner had to intervene because I kept trying to say like, I'm sorry, I didn't know. But yeah, it was an interesting way to find out. But it certainly changed the game for me once I knew about that. Because like many people, you think, well, what's wrong with dairy? They've got to be milked. You know, and I was a bit embarrassed the fact that I didn't realize that, you know, cows had to be impregnated and have a baby to lactate, and you know what happened to that baby so we could have the milk. Just, you know, just don't think about it, do you?
Yeah. Personally, I used to ride horses, so I know the feeling, and I've had horses for most half of my life at least, and I know that sort of, for me anyway personally, it was that it took a while for me to kind of draw that connection to, yeah, like veganism and horses and riding horses and things like that. So I guess for you, having like your whole career basically in mounted police, like at what point did you sort of start to question whether that was in line with what you now believed in your values?
Yeah, that was such a tough one, because, you know, I was single and so I didn't have anyone else to prop me up while I sorted my life out, you know, with an idea of like doing something that wasn't involved with horses. So I literally, you know, that was obviously my profession, riding and teaching and putting horses in very stressful artificial environments like city spaces and demonstrations and the like. But also privately at home, I was coaching and training horses. And I think the real catalyst came, so just in a try and make it a shorter story, I'd injured my back at work and I was off for about 18 months on light duty, sort of cycling, you know, it'd sort of come a little bit better and then go again and all of that. And in the end, I ended up taking off overseas, backpacking. The plan was no plan for 11 months. And I'd signed up at the very end of that 11 months, I'd signed up to a 230K ultramarathon, staged ultramarathon in Costa Rica. And so I embarked on this life-changing, soul-searching, global roaming, and basically was just running all around the world. You know, I'd just go out all day and just run and hike, and finished with this rank. And what I realized once when I was traveling, because I went to a lot of very remote, out of the way, non-touristy places in a lot of sort of more developing nations like Morocco and places like that. So it was a real eye-opener. It also taught me to see, you know, I was quite a new vegan, probably only when I first left Australia, it was only about 6 month vegan, I suppose. So it was quite the learning curve of learning how to eat on the road, like traveling, especially in some funny, like little places. But I actually saw it as an adventure, like it was fun to me, because I find fun in things that are a little bit difficult, you know. So people go, oh, it's so hard to eat vegan when you're traveling. Like, no, it's not. It's as hard or as easy as you want it to be. And, you know, you've got to also think I was running like most of the day, most days. So I had quite the furnace to fuel, and I still managed fine. You know, if you want to go to fancy restaurants in all these different countries, that's probably going to be harder. But everyone, all these little countries have markets and souks and where the locals eat, and you're buying the legumes and the fruit and the vegetables. And, you know, probably if anything, I probably could have had a bit more protein and things like that. It probably wasn't perfect, but, you know, these days you'd have a vegan multi and protein powder and stuff like that with you. But, you know, I did fine. And I had so much energy because I was training all the time. I was peaking. But yeah, you know, while I was out there, I did realize that I certainly didn't want to teach privately anymore. So I wrote to all my clubs and said, I'm so sorry. I'm just giving you a heads up. I won't be coming back to coach. And did explain why. I just said, I'm just seeing, you know, I went vegan and I just see how we use horses and all animals a little differently. And I wanted to say it, you know, like why, but in a very non-preachy, judgmental way. Just, it's just not sort of where I'm at now. But work was something else. Like, you know, work that paid my mortgage, and I'd taken out a second loan for my mum to upgrade her retirement situation. So that was difficult. Like, I didn't feel like I'd done that since I was 20. What can I do if I'm not doing training horses? That was my talent. I was good at it, you know, so it was a bit scary. So I thought I was going to have to go back to the police force and maybe retrain over 2 or 3 years and just suck it up and do what I had to do. But I only lasted like three weeks back in the police force, and I had a meltdown at firearms training, like literally started crying on the firearms range. And yeah, so my existential crisis, I called it.
And so at that point, you just completely, like, you just resigned from the police force?
No, I mean, it was too daunting. Like, I still didn't know how I was going to pay bills. So I had a lot of sick leave up my sleeve because I'd never really used much sick leave. So I went off on sick leave. It was just, you know, stress, anxiety. Looking back too, like, with the benefit of, you know, the hindsight of where I am now, I think, you know, part of it, I was perimenopausal. So probably heightened emotions there as well, but I didn't realize that at the time. And I was quite, I sort of took umbrage at anyone, like someone did, a psychiatrist did suggest that. And I was like, no, it's not, you know, but like, she probably was right. But, you know, it was a big deal. And I did actually hold a lot of shame about letting my colleagues down, because I had been a key player with the training of the police horses. And they had been very patient with me because I was just about to come back to work, recovering from this long injury with my back. And then I said, I'm not ready. I was really worried I'd hurt it again. So I just took off for a year. So then they patiently wait for me again. And then I last 3 weeks and I'm saying, oh, I'm on sick leave. And I was never that person. I'm not someone to manipulate the system, you know, but it was very, very genuine. I had a lot of anxiety about it, a lot of shame that I was letting them down, a lot of confusion, like, I can't do this policing thing anymore. Like, who am I if I'm not a cop? It was a bit like what I went through when I was injured. Like, who am I if I'm not this physical person? It's a really interesting time. And also the fact I was perimenopausal, like, it was tough. Like, it was a tough time for me. So
yeah. And then at what point did you sort of realize that you wanted to start a B&B?
I fell into it. So when I got back from traveling and my sort of world fell apart, because I thought, oh, okay, I'm on sick leave now and I just can't stomach the idea of, like, continuing to do things with the horses, even doing things that I considered going to another department. But even then, I actually wanted to do activism. I joined Animal Liberation Victoria while I was overseas. I wrote to them and, you know, declared, like told them who I was, because I knew they were doing all this activism and I wanted to join them. I became a member of Animals Australia, but I wanted to be with Animal Liberation Victoria because they were doing a lot of activism and I was, you know, quite inspired to do activism. But that's, you know, that's obviously going to come into conflict with my role as a cop. So when I joined, I said, look, is it okay? I just want you to know I am actually a serving member of VicPol. Is it okay that I join? I just want to be up front. And apparently Patty Mark, who started ALV like, you know, 45, 50 years ago or something, she cried because they'd actually had undercover police like infiltrate their activism many, many years ago when ALV was considered like, you know, what would be looked at as a terrorist type thing now, like, you know, it was radical. So yeah, they'd taken people in and been very close with them and they were undercover cops. So apparently she was like so moved that an actual serving member was now like legitimately supporting what they do. So yeah, I wanted to do that. And literally the day, 2 days before I had the meltdown at firearms training, I was actually on the water illegally rescuing ducks, some duck season opening. I'd just run 230Ks in that Costa Rica ultramarathon, so I knew no one was going to catch me. And I'd already told the other ALV members that, like, I could not get caught. Like, I could not. So I said, if I disappear, don't worry about me. Like, I'm just going to be running through the marshes. my word was no fat cop's going to catch me. They wouldn't have gone out in the water anyway, to be honest. So
so when you say you just fell into B&B, like, did you just sort of think, like, I've got this? Because you said you had 20 acres in Victoria, like at the Yarra Valley, so you just thought this is a great opportunity?
Well, how it actually happened was when I was off on sick leave, I was like, I was in a bit of a tither, you know. I was I missed traveling, the simplicity of living out of a backpack. I missed travelers and people that didn't know me because everyone was concerned about me, you know, colleagues, family, because I was going through this existential crisis. And I just thought, I'd stayed in a few Airbnbs traveling. So I thought, you know what, I've got a spare room downstairs, I'm going to do Airbnb. And I loved it because I could just talk to these strangers about travel and traveling, you know, and that's all I wanted to talk about. I just wanted that escape from life. Yeah. So I did that for a few months until the penny, I was doing, you know, vegan breakfast just by default, you know. So, you know, I wasn't doing dinners then. Like, dinner is not always an option now. But back then it was just breakfast and vegan breakfast. And I did ask them not to bring animal products onto the property because that was important to me. So it was good. But it literally took at least 6 months for me to realize, like, oh, perhaps I could actually do this as a business. So that's how it was born. So I started with Airbnb in Easter 2014, like just, I don't know, like a month or two after I got back from traveling. And then by the end of the year, I had a registered business and, you know, yeah, got the website started and started to do that. So yeah, it was a very, very tiny little business for a long time. It's still not exactly huge. But.
And what made you move to Queensland?
Look, in 2014, so when I was in Costa Rica, I actually realised, to my surprise, I actually didn't mind humidity because I always thought I did. And I loved Costa Rica. And a lot of elements, because I'm doing this ultra marathon, I'm up there in the mountains and in the jungle and like doing these long days up there. And I thought, I love this. Like, I felt amazing. I was very high roar at that part, at that place. And I thought, it's like Queensland. I should go to, yeah, I could live in Queensland because, you know, I thought I could live in Costa Rica, but it's way too far. So when I came back early in that piece, I actually did take a week and came up to Queensland and did a bit of a recce, you know, a bit of a reconnaissance and had a look for the future because I didn't want to leave while Mum was still alive. I thought for a while, you know, I might have to sell the farm. And so I did put it on the market for a while. But by the time, you know, someone had actually said, yeah, I want to buy your house, I'd started the business. And I was feeling like, actually, this is something I want to explore. I'm enjoying this. So I knocked them back. that's how, you know, continue with the business. Mum died in May 2019. And, you know, 2 weeks after that, I thought, do I still want to move? Like, you know, do I want to do this now? I'm not getting any younger. So, you know, I was about 58 then. So, so I moved. I came up, looked at, like, my property sold really, really fast, like in 10 days, rather, three people wanting it. So I jumped on a plane, came up and looked at 25 houses in 3 days and bought this one, fell over this one. This wasn't on my plan. It was, of course, 100 grand more than my top budget, but that's life. But it's the perfect place. It's just gorgeous.
And so tell us about what you do at the Beat Retreat, like what you sort of offer and yeah, like people coming in, what do they experience?
Yeah, I mean, it's changed a little bit since I was in Victoria because the place is different. So I think now I probably specialise more, like certainly still have the B&B stay, so just a straight stay. People come, they stay, and I give them breakfast, maybe not dinner, whatever they want. They might want to eat in Noosa. But I think there's a lot more of the retreat packages that people take up when they're here, because I still have a lot of southern state people come. Certainly still, you know, quite a lot from Brisbane and the Sunshine Coast. They just want a little break. But the ones that come from further afield, particularly my main, maybe Melbourne, Sydney, Adelaide, they come up for either the 3-night package or the 7-night package. And the 3-night package is just called an escape retreat. So basically they get their dinners, they get obviously the breakfasts, they get a guided hike, they use the sauna, and it's, yeah, you know, cooking class and things like that. So it's a simple retreat offering, like, and then they can add some extras on. The 7-night Empower Retreat is very bespoke, and it's different things to different people. So it's literally there for people to contact me and have a conversation and tell me what they need, because people sometimes come for mental health reasons. They need a safe, quiet space, especially if they're a bit introverted and they don't want to go to a wellness retreat and be with 30 other people. So coming into this space, it's just me. There's no, like, partner, and they can be looked after in whatever way they need to be looked after. So have their healthy, yummy meals supplied to them, have my three cats and a dog, like all my little rescues, and nature, and be tranquil. And they may or may not go into Noosa. You know, just to be somewhere safe, where they can have conversations with you or not, you know. So it's really, I'm guided by what they need. So then I have people that have had perhaps cancer or some sort of like health crisis, and they want to learn more about going fully plant-based or partially. And then if it's that, they do have to see a plant-based dietitian first and allow me to be privy to that information so I can tailor an appropriate meal plan and cooking class structure for them, because if people do have, you know, one size doesn't fit all when it comes to a plant-based diet. Some people really can't have certain things. So I really enjoy the 7-night ones because you really get to know the person, and because it's generally one-on-one or one-on-two, because, you know, couples come, you can really help people and you build a relationship with them.
Do you have any kind of understanding of, yeah, like the kind of ratio of people that come that are vegan versus non-vegan?
Oh, yeah, always has been about half and half. I would say it's like the wonderful thing about having a vegan B&B, even though it probably does diminish your overall, like, I'm sure I'd get a lot more bookings if it wasn't, and it's, you know, quite proudly vegan. I've had people right from the start say, you should really call it plant-based. And no, because I'm very proudly vegan. It is my values. Like I said, plant-based is a diet, and I am very interested in teaching people to do it the healthier way, because I actually see healthy plant-based eating, or, you know, eating vegan food as a form of advocacy, because I don't have any problem with eating like vegan treats, but if we make it the predominant part of our diet, we will get sick, just like anyone else that's eating a generic mostly processed or high fat, high sugar diet, they're going to get sick. The trouble is when they get sick and they've been vegan eating that way, it's the vegan diet, not that they're eating a crappy diet. So I actually see teaching people healthy vegan food is another branch of my own advocacy for keeping people vegan, because we know that so many people don't stay vegan because, like myself, when I was a vegetarian, I was tired. So instead of seeing a dietitian and finding out why I was tired, I made my own decision. And this is what most people do. They just listen to their friends. They don't go to a dietitian. They don't even cost that much, dietitians, like a plant-based one. You've got to have a plant-based one, because people that are just dietitians, they generally are just a bit dismissive of a vegan diet. Otherwise, they'd be doing it themselves. So that's why I get people to go and see a plant-based dietitian, because they need to have that full knowledge about a plant-based diet. Whereas a normal dietitian, they'll know quite a lot, but they really won't know, because it's not in their, they're not that interested in it, you know, they won't learn the nuances of it.
Yeah. And what's like your favorite part or like the highlight of what you do at the Beet Retreat?
I love connecting with people. And the thing is, like I said, it's self-selecting because it's a vegan B&B. So even though half of my guests aren't vegan, I actually like that, because I'm not always just singing to the choir. The whole point of the B&B is to be, it's my gentle advocacy. So, you know, I used to say when I was doing a lot of activism as well, so, you know, going to the down into Brooklyn to you know, JB Swift, which is sheep and cattle. And then we'd go over to Diamond Valley Pork, and just near there, the chickens were there as well. So I was doing a lot of very early morning activism as well, and holding the thing. But, you know, you're burning the candle at both ends, because I was working huge hours with the B&B and also looking after the animals. You know, I had the horses and the rescue sheep and everything. And it was a lot of work and a big property. I said, like, truthfully, anyone can hold a placard and bear witness. And though it was important to me that I did some of that so I could share it on my socials, as I started to get a bit of a following, it was wearing at me. And I also found it very difficult in my cooking classes of, say, you know, I'd have eight people in a cooking class and I'd do them regularly. Usually only one or two of those would be vegan. And they would forget where they were sometimes. And when we were having a lull and they'd be chatting, they'd perhaps be talking about this delicious pork belly they had, you know, and it was difficult for me. And especially if I was tired and emotional, it was hard. So in the end, I just thought, you know, I'm going to wind back on the activism. I just did, you know, a bit of marshalling, like for, you know, Dominion marches and things like that. And it just, you know, anyone can really hold a placard, but not everyone could do what I was doing at that sort of different level of teaching people to go more plant-based. And the beauty of doing that too, it gave me an opportunity of talking to people about my experience. So you're subtly exposing them to the fact of the dairy industry without telling them. I'm speaking of my experience. So my thing was, I would get everyone to introduce themselves and perhaps say why they came. And then I'd always finish with me, like why I'm vegan. And that gave me the opportunity to present the facts about the dairy industry. And you could see, like, I would make a very, I knew the impact that that had on a lot of people. So, but I would always just sort of like glance around, never target anyone, but I could see that flicker of like, oh my God, I didn't know that. But you wouldn't bang on about it, you know, you'd say, oh, this is why I went vegan. And you've given the message without talking at someone, which I find very powerful. And I tried to have these conversations sometimes with particularly younger activists. No one wants to feel judged. No one wants to feel like they're a bad person. And if you start like doing this one at people, they close down really quickly. If you talk about your feelings when it's like appropriate, you've got to sort of sometimes maneuver the conversation carefully. And also watch for when they start to glaze over.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's been a wonderful place to have dinner table conversations. I never direct the conversation to veganism, but because you know, things just come up. People know you're out running all day and, you know, you're this age or whatever, and they ask the questions, and then as it's appropriate, things come up. So it's great activism, like in this very subtle, communicable way.
Yeah. You just mentioned as well about having rescue animals. Tell us about them.
Ah, yeah. So the sheep weren't mine. The sheep were, they actually still live at my old property. So the lovely lady that she's connected with, which one are they? I think they're VLA, Victorian Lamb. Yeah, anyway. Anyway, you know, there's the two. I always get them mixed up. But anyway, she's with one of those organisations, and she has all these rescue sheep. So she approached me if she could adjust the sheep there. And I was like, yeah, sure, absolutely. So I had my couple of old rescue horses and a couple of friends' horses there as well. And but when I sold, you know, we were quite worried about what was going to happen to the sheep. But so fortunately, the new owners of the property were actually going to get some pet sheep. So, and they are all still there, and now there's only sheep there, and she's been able to expand that, and they're very on board. And I'm sure she's, you know, over the last 4 years, they're probably, I don't know if they're vegan, but I bet they're, you know, she has some nice conversations with them. Yeah. So, and then my two old horses, they were too old to come up here. So my best friend down in Victoria, she has them on her farm. And when I come down to Victoria twice a year, I stay there and I see my horses, but I do miss them. I must say that's a bit hard, but it would have been all about me if I'd brought them up here, and they're very happy and spoilt rotten. One's 40 years old, like, oh, you know, wow. Your little pony, Banjo. Yeah, he's still going, amazing, because I rescued him at 33 when he was skin and bone. No idea that he could, you know, he bounced back within 8 weeks. It was quite remarkable, little pony.
And where you currently are now, you mentioned you've got, was it two cats and a dog?
Three. Yeah, three. They're all obviously all rescues. So they all came up from Victoria with me, even my half wild one called Crazy Cat. So Crazy Cat, initially I was sort of thinking that he'd never cope, but he really did. So I'm really glad I bit the bullet and brought him up. But yeah, so they're all here. One of my little girl cat, she's sick at the moment, so just waiting for some more tests next week. So a little bit worried about her, but you know, they're all getting on a bit, but they're great.
Yeah. And I know as well that I was reading on your website that you're hoping to get like registered there for be part of Land for Wildlife. Like, talk to us about that.
Well, when I came to Queensland, like I wanted to make a subtle shift, because, you know, I'm 3 acres instead of 20 here, and I'm abutting 90 acres of dedicated land for wildlife that's protected forever. So the people that live on the far side of the 90 acres that divides us, they bought this land specifically to protect it forever, and they've done something legally that means, like, when they die, their kids can't sell it. It's sort of going to go to some sort of crown land, because it's an important wildlife corridor, especially for koalas. So I'd made that decision because I wasn't going to do so much rescue, have the rescue animals, because I used to also have chickens as well. That all actually passed before I sold the property anyway. So because, you know, we're old rescue hens. So I thought, you know, I'd really like to focus on, you know, continue that healthy food thing, but really focus on environmental and conservation, because though I went vegan purely for ethical reasons, to the point of really not knowing, I didn't think that going vegan would actually be the healthiest option for me. Like, I literally said, well, no one's dying of being vegan. Even if I'm not as healthy as I was, I'll be okay. And, you know, soon after, I learned that it was a very healthy diet done right. So that was like, oh, bonus. So I'm really happy about that. So, you know, that was a big part of my advocacy. But then, you know, I started to learn more and more about environmental impact of animal agriculture and just conservation issues. And I'd always been a bit green leaning even before I went in the police force, you know, as a young person. I got a little bit black and white when I was in the cops, because that sort of happens to you as a young person. You sort of get a little bit indoctrinated into these are the laws, these are the rules, no gray area. And so going vegan, like, all the grays came out. Literally, like, with my hair. And so the first thing I did when I moved here was put like a really big solar setup on my roof. I'm going towards sort of like being fully electric here and having battery storage. And then the other thing was to do land for wildlife and get sustainable, like my own organic fruit and veggies happening. So that all, you know, has been happening over the last 4 years. I've been pretty impacted financially, obviously, like everyone in these last 4 years. So it's not been the easy transition I expected it to be. I thought I'd be at a certain place now, and I'm way behind, but that's fine, you know, delayed gratification. But I've probably put in now about 550 more native plants. So I'm just letting everything like grow now. I've got, I'm sort of rewilding down the back area of my 3 acres and making the like windy paths through there. So the idea is at the moment I've got this, you know, beautiful park-like, it's beautiful to look at because it's very park-like with these, you know, big trees. But the trouble is small animals, like, you know, I just looked at the ducks and ducklings go past yesterday. And the thing is there was a long gap between like the bush and the dam on the neighbour's property. And they just get picked off by hawks. You know, there's not enough cover. And same with the various lizards, like the bearded dragons, and when the little possums come down and have little sugar gliders. When you have the vegetation with, you know, narrower spaces, they're much safer, and also more densely planting like prickly things and things, so you can get small birds come back. You know, got the maggies and you know, the different bigger birds, but not much in the way of smaller birds because they're too vulnerable. So, yeah, so that's a sort of like a transition. I'm with the Humane Society as like, you know, sort of like a land for wildlife, but that's, you know, a different setup. You've got to meet certain criteria that's more strict with actual, so I'm doing what they call working towards registration with land for wildlife, and the council people like, you know, support you in that. So, you know, as far as coming out and telling you like, you know, this is what you've got in your property and that would be good to plant there. So yeah.
And I guess before we move on to the, I'm really excited to hear about your like ultra journey and things, but before that, is there anything else with the property like that you wanted to talk about in terms of like any hopes for the future or things, or, you know, if you're looking at doing events or any other, anything else that you wanted to share?
Yeah, look, I do, because it's only 2 bedrooms here, so the maximum people amount of people I can have here, well, sort of 5, really. It's generally 4, but the main bedroom, the sunrise room, that can have the option of an inflatable single because I've got this massive walk-in robe and it's sort of perfect for putting a little. So, you know, if I have a teen or 3 friends come, I've only got queen-size beds, you know, people are like happy to share or whatever, like, you know, they're fine, they don't mind. Sometimes, like, if they're not happy to share, I'll have like 2 friends and one will be on the inflatable signal and in the bed. But I can't have like big events here. My kitchen is much smaller, so I don't do cooking classes for, you know, I wouldn't do more than 4 people, 3 preferably. Occasionally I'll hold a bit of a gathering here. So I had a like a lunch for about 15 women that were from a local paddling group that I used to paddle with. And, you know, I don't think anyone was vegan, but like it was really good that they wanted to come. So they were thrilled with their big spread. But I run a retreat in Bali for midlife women and older. And that's something that only started this year. And because I really do find that like a big part of my demographic, because I'm 61 and I wrote a 120-page ebook with like 80 recipes in it that really sort of support people at any age, really. But there is a real a focus on midlife health. So, you know, with the nutrients that will help support that across the board. So it's just sort of like, you know, I guess my main demographic is sort of like that mid-30s to sort of like mid-60s. And a lot of solo women come because it's nice for a solo woman to come somewhere where they feel like at home. So they can come to breakfast, they can come to dinner in their jammies if they like, you know, like they're not, they can, if they always feel like they have to look a certain way, like they just see me knocking around, you know, and they're just like, oh, sweet. And then the next day they've got no makeup on and like they're wearing whatever. And it's just so nice to be able to give people a space like that. So I really love the retreats, either that the Bali one allows me to have more women that come together so you could, they can really foster friendships. Like all those women are still talking. We have a WhatsApp group and, you know, real friend, they're catching up with each other. They live in other states and they're catching up with each other. It's, you know, half of them weren't vegan, but it's just the women supporting women is a big thing for me. And, you know, just doing any of the retreats here. But, yeah, there probably is more of a shift with, the, you know, more my clientele is more female, but couples as well. But I am starting to get more solo males come because I think they're becoming more aware that they want to learn to eat healthier. So I do have someone coming from Adelaide for 2 weeks, a guy whose daughter is a GP and vegan, and she's encouraged him to go plant-based. So he's coming to learn all the things, which is great. He's going to surprise his family for Christmas, apparently, and say, I'm vegan. And then, yeah, I've had a few other guys come because they've had some health crises, you know. Yeah. So it's nice.
I just actually thought, I never asked you, how did you get the name The Beet Retreat?
Ah, yeah, it just sounds cute, right? Because people say, like, why beet? And I said, yeah. Beet Retreat. Like, just boom, boom. No reason.
I thought it might have been like your favorite vegetable or there was some story to do with it.
I have to, okay, full disclosure, I have to say it's not my favorite vegetable at all. I have it most days because beet and beet juice is actually very good athletically. So I always have it in my smoothies and I grow it in my organic veggie garden. But yeah, it's not my favorite thing. So there's the irony.
Well, it sounds like a good segue, actually. But you just said that you've only just started to get back into, like, ultra marathons, endurance running. But it sounds like you've done it for most of your life. Like, is that something you did, like, in your early years?
No, not at all. I didn't start doing stuff until I was 45. Yeah, it's quite the midlife crisis, yeah. How it happened was, you know, was born of heartbreak. Probably. I broke up with my live-in partner at that time. We both still loved each other, but he wanted to have children and he was quite a bit younger than me. So that was always my agreement with him that if he felt like he needed, he realized eventually that he might want children, he'd need to tell me and we'd need to part company. So that's what happened. So it was very sad. But I, you know, did a few things. I was just sort of like, just pottering around, recovering for a couple of years, but I ended up going to Africa and climbing Kilimanjaro with friends. And while I was away, I just had this thing, like I really enjoyed training for this with people and I'm ready to sort of like come back out into the world. And I remembered he'd showed me this 2-day adventure race and I'd sort of like, he goes, we should do this. And I'm like, God, no, like that looks horrific. And I thought, well, I'll have a look at that adventure racing thing when I get home. So I did. And adventure racing is, it can be anywhere from a sprint one, which is like 3 hours, to this World Series thing, which I've done two of now, which is like multi-days, usually about 700 to 800 kilometres, nonstop, unsupported, team of four. You do it all together. And it's mountain biking, trekking / running. Kayaking, and then they've got all these other little weird things like, you know, canyoneering and abseiling and all sorts of strange things thrown in there. So I actually got into that in a big way and I was just passionate about it, that multi-sport, which is a solo version of those three main sports on a marked course, whereas adventure racing's map and compass navigation. So that's how I got into endurance sports and I had this whole new circle of friends and it just changed my life. It was wonderful. And then I injured my back at work. I'd also been doing with another guy I was, you know, ended up with later. I was doing mountaineering with him and had some wonderful adventures around the world climbing mountains with him. But after we broke up, I injured my back about that time and I wasn't able to sit for a long time. So I couldn't cycle and I couldn't paddle. And I was sort of going out of my mind, but I was allowed to walk as much as I wanted to once I could walk. And then eventually I could walk, jog. And that led me into ultra running because by picking mountain ultras, like more technical ultras, you have to walk, run. You can't just run, 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 which would destroy my back. So that's how the endurance running started, because I could, and I just missed being out in wild places. That and long distance, like solo hiking, like doing multi-day solo hiking. They were my things, because just being in nature, being in wild places is just my jam. Like, I love it.
And so, like, tell us about, you said when you went to Costa Rica, it was part of like, yeah, this bigger kind of event. So, or style of like adventure running. So tell us about that.
So Costa Rica, literally how that came across my radar is when I was quite early on in my injury, when I was sitting at home, the lonely girl on the farm, looking at YouTube as you do when you're feeling miserable, unable to walk down my driveway to, like, you know, feed the horses or anything. And for some reason, I fell across this this race, the Coastal Challenge, on YouTube, and it had this incredibly beautiful footage of runners running through shallow rivers with dappled jungle light and evocative Peruvian music playing, you know, like really haunting, and this sort of like it just caught my imagination. Like, literally the hair on the back of my neck stood up, and I was like, got really emotional. I thought, I'm going to do this race, you know. So I signed up for it, which was hilarious considering where I was at the time. And, you know, I was getting better, and, you know, I think I had about 10 months or something, so I thought I'd be okay. But I sort of tried to come back too quickly. And, yeah, it was quite apparent 6 months before the race that this was not going to happen this year. So I ended up postponing it for a year. And they said, well, they said to me that I could have half of my deposit back if I entered the following year. So I did that. But, like, looking at the prices of flights to Costa Rica, a bare bones around the world flight was not much more expensive than flying to, you know, to America, down to Costa Rica. So that's how that happened, you know, and it was, again, it was really quite life-changing. It's interesting, a lot of things that are most important to me in my life have just sort of happened. I think they're born of circumstance. So I think going vegan, like, I'd already started to learn, but when I went vegan, you have, you know, you start to learn things and you develop this empathy. I had some guests here that had won a stay here through, I don't know if you know of Doctors for Nutrition.
Yeah.
So that's a not-for-profit, and they basically sort of educate health professionals, but, you know, it's available for anyone to learn from. They do amazing work, and they have this big symposium conference every year, and I donated a stay to them. So I had this lovely the Chinese, I think, two doctors come, and they just left the other day. But they're not vegan, you know, but they were really, you know, they're intelligent people, so they were asking really good questions, which was wonderful. And gotten where I was going with that, but something that, you know, they did ask me these things, and it's just like, again, that beautiful way of just very openly but not forthrightly talking about vegan things and why vegan and what it's done for me, like being able to develop, I think, yeah, so I was going to say is, because they asked me about, like, I did a lot of Yes campaign volunteering for The Voice, and I'm very passionate about that. And the male doctor was actually, he works a lot with Indigenous communities, which is, like, amazing. So we had some great conversations. But they asked me about how, you know, I said that going vegan was sort of like, I've always described it as like peeling an onion. I just went from a very black and white, narrow-minded cop, because, like, I admit, when I was a cop, my only experience with Indigenous people was seeing them in a park in St Kilda drunk. So I just thought, Indigenous people are lazy and they're drunks. End of story. Didn't think to ask about anything else or why. Why is that happening? And going vegan and maturing, probably, you start to ask the questions about a whole lot of things in life, not just about animal rights. So I'm really grateful for going vegan, because I think it has grown me as a human being in myriad ways, and made me a much more caring and thoughtful human being. You know, I wasn't a bad person, you know, but I was a bit like, you know. In retrospect, I'm like, oh God, so embarrassing. I think of so many. We always make mistakes, right? I still make mistakes. So. Exactly. Still stay and do dumb things. So.
And you're in the process at the moment, aren't you, of training for an event that's coming up next month?
Yeah. So in about 3 or 4 weeks, I'm coming down to Victoria and I'm doing an inaugural run across the Grampian Peak Trail, which is 160-kilometre, 7,700-metre ascent trail, the Grampians, the Garrowood. And it's my first ultra since 2016. I did a big fundraising run for 5 different animal rights orgs and sanctuaries in 2016 across the Pyrenees in France. So then I did 616 kilometres in 11 and a half days and we raised $6,500 from my supporters and I. So it was an amazing experience, brutal. But I sort of pretty well retired after that and didn't really race again. I've done a handful of little races, like 25 and 30K races, basically on no training, which is like dumb because it's still far enough that you're going to hurt if you don't train for those. But I saw this race came up and I've always wanted to go back to the Grampians. I haven't been there for decades. And, you know, an inaugural race is exciting and it was gnarly enough for me to take the training seriously. Like it's going to really seriously hurt and it's probably going to be hot and brutal. Got 4 days. I'm doing the 4-day staged version. So like it averages around 50 kilometres and 2,000 metres ascent each day. So it's hard. Very hard underfoot, like, yeah, technical. Yeah. And I've linked it with a fundraiser for an animal sanctuary up here. They used to be on the sunny coast, now they're up near Gympie, and that's called Happily Heifer After, and they do great work. So I'm just setting up there. The platform, the fundraising platform, what I want to do, they're just signing up to that hopefully this weekend. So I'll be putting details up for that, and hopefully I'd set our target for 1160 because it's 160 kilometers I'm running, so I hope to raise that for them together with the supporters. And yeah, it's always been important for me. It just seems the right fit. I mean, I see as a person of 61 that came to endurance sports late, you know, most of it has been as a vegan. My big events have certainly been, bar one, has been as a vegan. And it's a wonderful way of raising awareness about these various charities and sanctuaries and organisations, but also the health benefits. Because I'm an older one, it does help. It's a benefit of being older, especially with the grey hair now. Like people go like, oh, you know, and she's been vegan 12 years. Like, you know, can't be that bad. Makes people interested and ask questions. And so it's a great vehicle for me to do fundraising. The thing is I get also, I shared something on Instagram the other day. It also, I've always said, like I'm a bit of a sook. Like it is hard out there. It's very hard. And it's a big mental game as well. You just want to stop a lot. But when you're doing it for a bigger reason, you'll keep going. It's like going vegan for the animals. I've always said, if I just did it as a diet, I would break it every week. Because at the end of the day, like who cares if you have a croissant? Like, you know, if it's just a diet, you have a croissant once a week, who cares? But when you're doing it for ethical reasons, this is like you're flying in the face of your values every time you do it, you know. Like when I was a new vegan, when I was traveling overseas, I think 3 times I, you know, had something that had dairy in it, and it always took me like 2 weeks of just like this craving. I want a Magnum ice cream before they were vegan Magnums, right? I really want a croissant in France, you know. And eventually I'd just cave and I'd have it. And then, but what I'd do is really think about it. Think like, okay, so you just had dairy. Like, how does that make you feel? Knowing what you know, was it worth it? Like, you know, and it was always like, no, it's not worth it. So I've often said to people, newer vegans, don't just cave into every like craving you might have, but sit with it for a while. And if you end up caving, like, don't just eat it and forget it. Like, eat it and think about it. Like, and I, for me, never went there again. Like, so it's sort of valuable, because otherwise it was just in my head for like 3 weeks constantly. I want it. And then it seems deprivation. You have it and it's like, yeah, whatever, my taste buds have changed. And yeah, certainly my values have changed.
Yeah. And so with this event that's coming up in November, like, is it something that you, like, you'll have the opportunity also as well, like, when you're at the event, you'll be speaking to other people and things? Like, it won't just be, you know, solely, I guess, the people that follow you already that will know what you're doing?
Yeah, I mean, part of the thing is, like when I did the Pyrenees run, I had all these T-shirts made. So on the back, it had the Beet Retreat Vegan B&B, no meat, no dairy, no eggs, no problem. And then it had, like, you know, strength and compassion on this one, and vegan, like, on this one. And on the back had the five charities running for the five different charities. So I wear those T-shirts a lot. I will probably wear them sometimes when I'm on this run. Everyone in France knew that I was vegan. There was only three vegans out of the 300 odd runners. And it is like, you have these conversations, but again, like, I'm always like, as a more mature vegan now, like, I've learned, when I was a new vegan, I was the typical ranty, preachy, you. When you learn to coach that in different terms as you mature as an activist, I think not everyone does, but I don't think the only people that angry vegans really attract to veganism are the angry people, and they're not the best advocates, quite frankly. And a lot of them, you know, it's some sort of trauma within them. It somehow legitimizes their hatred of humans. And it's not, some of the angriest vegans I've known don't end up staying vegan. It's just been like a platform to them vent their spleen at other humans that aren't vegan. And it's really unhealthy and unhelpful. You know, some people say there's no bad forms of activism. I tend to disagree, but, you know, who am I to say? That's just my feelings. When I'm out doing what I do and I have these conversations, it allows me also, I'm not a good marketer about my own business. I'm very cringy about sales, which has been to my detriment. So when people, you know, talk about my business, like, this is fantastic, you know, it's great, because I'm just cringy about it. But when you have a reason to talk about, like, your business gets mentioned as a buy thing because you're just talking about this, you're fundraising for them. Yeah, and I'm the Beet Retreat fundraising for this. And that's the way I prefer to do things. So, yeah, they know you're vegan. You're fundraising for an animal sanctuary. It's a very nice way to come into it and say, I'm vegan, you know. Yeah. We all do that. I mean, I always joke about it. You know, everyone makes that joke about how do you know if someone's vegan, they'll tell you. I mean, yeah, a lot of the time I do tell people, but you tell people in different ways depending on the circumstance. Yeah. I love bringing the, you know, we had a thing after the referendum. Yes, volunteers, we had a bit of a gathering, and I'd made a lemon tart from the Kindness Echoes. You know, the Kindness Echoes on Instagram. I love Georgia. Georgia and Aaron came to the B&B many, many years ago, and I made sure I pre-ordered her book, The Vegan Home Baker. It was amazing. Should interview her. Anyway, I took the tart and I'd written yes in desiccated coconut. And of course I could say, you know, I have this vegan lemon tart, you know, and you vegan? Like, yeah, you know, I have a vegan B&B. And one of the ladies is having cooking classes here now. So, you know, these things are interesting because you can help people. They don't have I don't think there's any intention of going vegan, but they're older and they know they need to reduce their animal-based food consumption. So it's helpful. Everything's helpful.
Yeah. It's been incredible talking to you, Jen. Like, before we finish up, is there anything else that you did want to mention that we might have missed? I feel like we've done so well covering so much, but might have been something else you wanted to chat about.
Think so. I mean, I think I touched something. I guess I really wanted to say, because you know, your podcast is, you know, A Kind of Life, and probably is about activism and advocacy. I think I've already touched a little bit on how I view advocacy and activism, but I think for I think we've all got to find our own way. But I think it's really worthwhile remembering that we were where these people that we're trying to communicate with, be it family or friends or people at work that are like hanging crap on us about being vegan, we were that person too, maybe not quite so rudely, but we were also that person that was oblivious or like, you know, shrugged the shoulder or, you know, maybe quite venomous. I do have vegan friends that said they used to like just be merciless on vegan people that they knew, like merciless until they went vegan themselves. And I think while it's important not to, you know, be the whipping boy like for veganism, I think it's also important to remember where you were and to remember that like none of us like being told what to do. None of us like to be made feel like they're a bad person. No one wants to be that. And I just think you're going to go a lot further by building this communication and relationship somehow before you start launching into, you know, getting all preachy. Well, in fact, don't get all preachy. You know, learn to have conversations with people. I don't do it perfectly. I'll still get like triggered occasionally. I don't wade in. You've got to pick your battles a bit. I think you learn over the years that not to bang on to someone on social media, you know, that's just baiting you. Like, just don't waste your breath on them. You know, find someone that's like a little bit curious or, you know, and you just have those gentle conversations. And it is like, you know, finding your little niche, your little way of doing it and be a decent human being. I think it goes a long way to like, you know, shine your light.
Well, if people want, I'll obviously link your like your website and your social media through the podcast notes, but if people do want to reach out, follow your journey, even like you said, sponsor you in the upcoming like marathon you're doing next month for Happily Ever After. are you happy for people to reach out if they have any questions or want to follow your journey?
Of course. Yeah. Look, there's one thing like it with all my guests and anyone, just contact me anytime. Like my mobile's there. SMS me, you know, probably don't ring. That can be difficult. Catch me on the hop. But like DM, SMS me. If I don't know the answer to something, I usually know someone that can help. I don't profess to be the font of all knowledge with all things vegan and animal activism, but I have been around long enough and am well enough connected to be able to steer people in good evidence-based directions. Instagram is my most active because truth is I love making reels. Like it's sort of fun. It's my little creative thing. They're generally fun and lighthearted and a lot of like healthy, sporty, like me running around with the girls and mountain tops and at sunrise. I'm a real morning person and the animals and stuff. Probably Instagram, Facebook, I'm trying to go back to doing more of. They're the main platforms. I do have a blog, and I've just restarted that very intermittently. And you can sign up for the newsletter, which I sort of do infrequently. So you never get bombarded with me. I mean, that takes time for me to write a newsletter. So you might get one once a month.
I saw on the website, I love that you said it's less of a newsletter, more of a love letter. I thought that was
great. Yeah, because I literally want to. I resisted writing newsletters for 8 years of this business. It's been going like, you know, 9 and a bit years now, because I hate getting bombarded with emails and people's newsletter, and I hate salesy stuff. I think this is why I have trouble with marketing, because I have a bit of a trigger point for me if I'm being sold to or pitched to. I just find it immediately insincere, even if I want it. So I still am trying to find that way of telling people about my business without me cringing. You know, it's really hard because I need business. I want business, and people love coming here when they come here. But like, how do you do that without saying, "Whoa, here I am"? But you know, it's the same with the newsletter. Like, it really is like it's a letter from me to you. This is what's going on. This is what I'm doing. Like, this is a special I'm going to do. Often it's only for newsletter people. And then I might put it on Instagram later. So if it's some little, you know, I've had this little idea of this is what I want to do, you know, so it's fun.
Amazing. Well, I'm really grateful to Jess. She was on the podcast a few weeks ago and she actually said that she came up and stayed with you and went to the sanctuary. So, yeah, she was my inspiration for getting you on and I'm really glad she did. So thank you so much.
My absolute pleasure. It was lovely talking to you and lovely meeting you.
Thank you. And do you happen to have a favourite quote that you want to share with us to finish the episode?
Ooh, favorite quote. One that I've shared with a lot of people and it actually covers a lot of bases. But to me, Maya Angelou, do you know Maya Angelou?
Yeah.
Amazing woman. But she said, I've found that people forget what you said. They forget what you did, but they never forget how you made them feel. Mm. And even when I say it, I get a little choked up.
Yeah.
Because this is what I come back to. No one likes to be judged. No one likes to be made feel like they're shit, you know, and to try and remember that. And it's really powerful advocacy because I genuinely, you can see I'm a little bit teary.
Yeah.
I genuinely care about animals and people and the planet. Oh, I'm going to cry now right at the end of our.
I understand.
This is why the quote is so important to me, because I wish the world knew that, especially at this time, we know what's going on in the world.
Yeah.
You know, it's been a really, I've been struggling with sleep the last 4 or 5 weeks, the referendum and now what's going on in the Middle East, because I feel things quite deeply.
Yes.
And sometimes it's not always something that you want to engage with publicly, and sometimes things are. But I really try to always come back to that premise. It's more important how you make people feel. And if we all, you're crying. Are you crying?
Nearly.
But if we all came back to that, the world would be a different place, wouldn't it?
Yeah. It really. I know. I think it's hard for us as vegans, isn't it? Because we are empaths. So we, you know, we feel things so deeply. So yeah. And I love a lot of her quotes. Like a lot of them are very, yeah, very touching. So
yeah. I haven't finished out on a bit of a downer, but
no,
you know,
not at my all. Heart. No. Yeah. No, you've got beautiful energy and yeah, you can tell you're a very, like, very heartfelt person. So thank you so much, Jan. It's been beautiful to have you on. And as I said, I'll encourage everyone to jump across and help you in the upcoming fundraiser because it's such a great charity. I've had the Happily Ever After team here before. So we know all about them. Yeah. Michelle was on here. So it's really, really great that you're supporting them.
Thank you.
Thank you. Take care, lovely.
Thanks for joining us today. I would love to hear from you if you've been inspired by this episode or if you have any requests for future episodes. You can find me on Instagram at @akindlife. Remember, be kind to your body, kind to animals, and kind to our planet. Take care.